Welcome to the State of Shakespeare and part two of our interview with Epic Theatre Ensemble founding members Ron Russell and Jim Wallert. The subject is the Epic Theatre's new production of Richard III, Born with Teeth, which opened recently in New York City.
Jim and Ron, you have chosen to present the opening speech of Richard III, Born with Teeth. And as I understand it, you've made some addendums to the speech as it appears in the folio.
That's correct. Not a ton. We started with a lot more. Olivier puts about 80 new lines from Henry VI, Part 3 in the first speech. We didn't go down that road. So we played around with a lot of different options. What we've settled on is basically just three new lines in this speech and then some other lines from Richard and Henry VI, Part 3 in another section. But a couple of lines here that enhance, we think, the backstory of who Richard is and why he's doing what he's doing. The problem, I think, with Richard III is that you could walk into Richard III and not exactly know, if you weren't a Shakespeare buff, what this guy wants. And that's a great question in the play, is what does he really want? He says he wants the throne, but he gets that in Act 4, and that clearly is not satisfying. But you wouldn't even necessarily know that he wants the throne if you only read Richard III and you didn't know anything about the past history. So that's what we've done, is made those adjustments. I think it'd be great to hear Jim do it, and then we can talk a little bit about it.
Terrific.
Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments, our stern alarums changed to merry meetings, our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war hath smoothed his wrinkled front. And now, instead of mounting barbed steeds to fright the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute. But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass, I that am rudely stamped and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph, I that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, I, in this weak, piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time, unless to spy my shadow in the sun and descant on my known deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these farewell-spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days. And since this earth affords no joy to me, I'll make my heaven to dream upon the crown. Why, I can smile and murder whilst I smile, and wet my cheeks with artificial tears, and frame my face to all occasions. Plots have I laid, inductions dangerous by drunken prophecies, libels, and dreams, to set my brother Clarence and the king in deadly hate the one against the other. And if King Edward be as true and just as I am subtle, false, and treacherous, this day should Clarence closely be mewed up about a prophecy which says that G of Edward's heirs, the murderer, shall be. Dive thoughts down to my soul. Here Clarence comes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, it's funny. I'm just listening to you, and it might be your publicity photo that's in my head, but I just see you with a martini glass and just having this conversation with the audience. It's just a lovely reading.
Thank you.
Jim, it's such a remarkably free and easy, casual, and unforced reading. I wonder if this character that we meet at the beginning is consistent throughout the rest of the play.
I guess it depends on how you define consistent.
Yeah. He's consistent in his inconsistencies. He's consistent in that one of the things that makes this so much fun to play is that Richard is an actor. And for the first three acts of the play, in nearly every scene, he's playing a different character for the audience. He is so smart in his manipulation that he's able to sort of pick one of these people out and say, okay, who do they need me to be? who do they need me to be in order for me to get what I want from them? And so he's able to be the dutiful, outraged brother, or he's able to be this amazing, seductive guy for Lady Anne, or he's able to be this devout, religious man that has no interest in leadership whatsoever. Please don't ask me, but ask me again. So he's consistent in that respect, in that he is always, you know, sussing people out and seeing what role he needs to play. What's interesting about this play is once he finally achieves that objective of the crown, he's not playing a lot of roles from that point on. He's just the guy in charge. And I think that there's a level of dissatisfaction with that. You know, I got this and now what?
No more worlds to conquer.
No more worlds to conquer and no more plots to create. I think a lot of the fun that he has is in creating these plots and these kind of machinations and all of these different things. And his plans and his plots become really, they're not terribly complicated. It's like, well, I guess we better murder those two children now in the tower.
You raise such an interesting point that these people exist in a world that is entirely lacking in empathy. In a way, that seems to allow us to root for Richard not as the singular psychopath who's by definition lacks empathy, but more in the way that we root for maybe Michael C. Hall's character on Dexter, a psychopath who's ridding the world of other psychopaths, someone that we can really root for.
Yeah. I mean, he does have the benefit of most of the people he gets rid of are pretty terrible people and not nearly as clever as he is. And I think that's one of the things that Shakespeare does that's brilliant. I think it's something he does something similar with Iago and Othello, I think, is that in that I think we are meant to fall in love with this guy. I think we're meant to really connect with this guy for those first three acts. And when he becomes the king, it's, you know, I think there's a certain sense of satisfaction to that. And then it really turns. And I think it's that great thing of Shakespeare sort of shining the light on the audience a little bit and saying, you know, you were rooting for this guy. And it's I think we're supposed to have this kind of, oh, gosh, I don't feel so great about the team I chose, you know.
Yeah, I have a quote for you, which is, when Richard kills the children, the audience doesn't want to play with him anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and it's interesting to note that that's about the spot where his interaction with the audience, his soliloquies become much more sparse. He stops talking to the audience. And we are, as an audience, sort of shut out a little bit. And it's like, hey, wait a minute, we were a part of this. And he pushes everybody to the side, including to an extent the audience.
I think a big part of what Shakespeare defines as tragedy, which, you know, Richard III is a tragedy. We group it with the histories, but it's called the tragedy of King Richard III. Shakespeare defines tragedy largely as the revelation that you are singularly alone in the world, and no play does that more brutally than Richard. In fact, he puts words to that idea in his final soliloquy, the idea that he is completely alone and no one loves him. And why would they? Because he doesn't love himself. I think a similar thing happens with Macbeth.
Yep.
I think the same exact thing happens in King Lear. It's this revelation that you are alone and that you built that for yourself. You made that happen. You know, you were offered the opportunity to love or to be ethical or to change, and you didn't. And so you've kind of built your own prison. It's hard to work on as a director. It's frustrating because we've been working on the end of the play in rehearsal for the last week, and you know, you rip through those early scenes and all you've got to do really is figure out what is the scene are they acting? What movie are they doing? You know?
Right.
We actually use things like, oh yeah, you should Harrison Ford him there, you know.
Is there any Jim Carrey in there?
That's what they're doing, especially once he's with Buckingham. And he and Buckingham run three straight capers, you know? They're like crazy. And they're completely, it's like watching Ocean's 11, you know? Like, that's never going to work. And then it works, you know? And then suddenly, that's all gone, and Buckingham drops out right away. I mean, within pages after Richard's coronated, Buckingham's gone. And Richard's got very little artful work to do after that. So it just sort of all collapses, you know. And it's hard to create. It's hard to make. But we're learning as we pass through it again and again that we find ways to make it so that the world around Richard is no longer entertaining to him. If there's nothing fun in it, then he gets very frustrated very easily, and the end of the play sort of rolls towards its natural conclusion in an interesting and exciting way.
There's so many modern instances of plays that do that. I think it's a modern problem as well. But moving on to the speech, Garrett, do you want to talk a little bit about the speech?
I do. I have some questions about the language and some choices that you made, Jim. And I'm wondering what motivates these choices. In the speech, in what would be our line 7, there's a word there that we would say alarms in modern colloquial speech, I think. And it's changed for you in your reading. And I wonder what guides that choice. Do you know the word that I'm speaking of?
Yes. Let me see. That line is... Are stern alarums? Is that
yes. Why alarums and not alarms?
You know, it's a tricky thing, and actually we talk about it a lot in rehearsal. When to add the extra syllable or elide the extra syllable, you know, to keep the iambic pentameter, that rhythm. Where do you do it? Where do you not? And that was just one. In the particular text we have... actually spelled alarums. And we sort of went with that one. I feel like that's one that an audience can kind of track and you can sort of maintain the rhythm. There are other ones like if you were to adhere to the iambic pentameter strictly, then one might say, I am determined to prove a villain, right? And that always seems a little like, you know, he's determined. So it's just because we are looking at presenting this work for an audience that is, you know, new to Shakespeare and new to theater, we try to make that balance about adhering to Shakespeare's rhythm, the natural iambic pentameter, and a level of clarity.
Another one that came to my mind is in the very beginning, probably 8 lines of the speech, the ow sound is all over the place.
Yeah.
Now is the winter of our discontent. And so how, as an actor, do you notice that? And how do you... Is it difficult to get your mouth around that sound, or what do you think it means?
It's really, I mean, those ow sounds are, you know, now, browse, bound, our, all of those different things that you mentioned. They're certainly in there. And there is a level of getting the word A-R-E is different than O-U-R.
Mm-hmm.
It is a mouthful. It is definitely, you have to kind of navigate it a little bit and do it in a way that get clarity for an audience. It still wants to feel like natural, relaxed speech.
It certainly does in your reading. It certainly feels, it has the sense of colloquialism and today about it. Certainly the choices that you made with respect to the verse are not self-conscious or don't appear to be that way.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I you know, as Ron said earlier, some of the values for our work with Shakespeare is it's about clarity, it's about humor, and it's about speed. So when going through this particular speech or the entire play, those are sort of the guidelines that we use.
Well, that's a fascinating, your third item was speed, and in no way, shape, or form did I feel like you were rushing, that you were interested in speed in any way, and yet I didn't feel like the speech was overly long or you lost my interest.
Oh, great.
But to find the balance of that as an actor, and as you probably have experienced, most young actors will just start talking fast, and it seems to me that you've struck the balance really quite nicely.
Yeah, it's that tricky thing of wanting to keep the pace. I think primarily where that manifests itself is just in Shakespeare will let you know when it's okay to take a pause. He'll give you that indication in the text.
Well, that brings to light lines 14, 16, and 18. 14 starts with, but I then am not shaped for sportive tricks. As Garrett pointed out, that's where he goes from using the word our to using the word I. But those three lines, 14, 16, and 18, there seems to be an inherent stop after the I's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you see that, what do you say? What do you think as the actor and as the director approaching it?
It's a lot of hours in the first section. He's connecting with us. This is the only in the canon where the title character walks out on the very first scene and begins talking to us. It's the only instance in which it happens. And the fact that he uses the word our in all of those things is establishing that connection. And then, yeah, it does turn into I. That section is all about him. I sort of think of this speech as the first section beginning with the word now, which is this is where we are right now, a time of peace and comfort and relaxation. And then the second section beginning with that, but I, and he's saying, but this is why I stand alone. I am apart from all of this, you know, because of all of these things, because I'm shaped this way, because I will never find love, because dogs bark at me.
Yeah.
And then the third section being when he goes into and therefore. So it's very lined up that way. This is where we are. This is who I am, why I don't fit into this, and therefore this is why I'm going to mess everything up. This is why I am perfectly poised to take it all down.
The rhetoric of it, I mean, I think is part of what you guys are pointing out, which I think is great. The first section of the speech is all about reversals, what's been reversed. I mean, this is part of our production thinking, is that I've actually never understood why Richard III is always in black. I don't really get that. It seems very odd to me, the idea of it being a black martial world. It's quite the opposite. It's summer, which, again, I mean, I know is a metaphor, but it's a useful metaphor, right? It's summer, and there is no war. There's singing and dancing and sex and pool parties. So all of that has been set up for us, and I think Richard sets it up in a slightly ironic way for us, that, you know, aren't we so happy to be at peace, and then pulls it to, but look at me and see how I don't fit in that pool party, right? So that he brings that rhetorical device to bear his outsider status.
For those of us who would like to take in the show, could you remind us where and when we can see Born with Teeth by the Epic Theater Ensemble?
Absolutely. It is going to be taking place April 16th through May 4th. And we are at the Pershing Square Signature Center, which is at 480 West 42nd Street. And tickets are only $25 and $10 for a student rush.
Jim Wallert and Ron Russell, thank you so much for joining us today on The State of Shakespeare.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And thank you for listening.
Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.